Hello, everybody. My name is Todd Steed. This is the Best of Flipside. This is kind of something special. So I had Del Bryant on an original Flipside. He's the son of Felice Mbudlo Bryant, who wrote Rocky Top, Wake Up Little Susie, Love Hurts, so many fabulous songs, hundreds of fabulous songs. And we had so much to talk about that we could not fit it in a 30-minute show. So we kept on talking, and we talked about a lot more about Felice Mbudlo Bryant and a little more about Rocky Top. So here's part two of my interview with Del Bryant, the son of Felice Mbudlo Bryant, the great American songwriters. Also, he was, I believe, the CEO of BMI. So he has his own amazing story as well. I wish we could have gotten to everything. But this is definitely one of my favorite interview subjects. We'll pick up the interview where I'm asking him about where his dad was specifically from in Georgia. Where in Georgia was he from exactly?
He was from Shelman, Georgia, which is not far from the Alabama line. And then later moved, his family moved to Moultrie, Georgia, which is not far from the Florida line, South Georgia, deep south. And that's indeed where I was born. That was where his family finally settled down and remained in forever. So he was a deep South Georgia boy, and it was to the deep South that they shortly after meeting repaired. It was the area that Dad could always easily find work. He was very famous in his home area, and so he could always go down there when it got too cold or when the gigs got a little bit sparse, or when he just got tired of gigging with some of the groups he had been with. He could always go down south and work easily. And it was down there that he was working when he would come home late at night, and Mom would be working on her poetry and her songs. And it was in that southern setting that they really started writing their songs.
And the songs are just incredible. I mean, they've really stood the test of time. The lyrics are great. The melodies are fantastic. The ability to tell a story is always there. I mean, if you really study the songs themselves, they're exceptional. Are you surprised that people still care so deeply about these songs and that these songs seem to have an infinite life?
I'm really not, in that the songs are exactly what you said. They're so well crafted. The work that had been so popular when they were first together and when they first started writing was Annie Get Your Gun. That had been just huge in New York. And of course you still hear those songs. They were well crafted songs. Well, Mom and Dad, when they were writing Country Boy and Out Behind the Barn and some of their really early songs, I'm a Little But I'm Loud, It May Be Silly But Ain't It Fun, I could go on for a long while with that specific type Jimmy Dickens type song. Those songs, when they started writing those songs, they really weren't writing for Jimmy Dickens. They weren't writing for a country audience. They, through my father, knew what country was. He had milked many a cow before school in the morning and was proud to show you his milking muscle and his thumb. And he was a country boy. He was raised in the Deep South, but he was as I said earlier, very erudite, very learned, and had played a lot of jazz around the country. So, and had listened to a lot of those classic songs, the Cole Porter, the Johnny Mercer, who he was very proud was a Georgian. So when they started writing, they thought they were writing highbrow. They thought that Country Boy, Jimmy's second hit and one of his biggest, the one that established my folks and helped establish Jimmy Dickens, they sort of thought they were writing a highbrow kind of Annie Get Your Gun song. And when that took off, and a couple of the other songs that they had been writing started to take off, they were about as amazed as anybody that they were all of a sudden touted as great country songwriters. But rather than mess with the formula and mess with the title, they just dug in and started writing more and more of them. And then Dad, who really understood what country life was, He'd been raised in it. He started gearing things more and more to those type songs and started writing what I think you have to say was classic country, songs like Take Me As I Am or Let Me Go, songs done by Jimmy and Jim Reeves and Bob Dylan. Everyone cut that one. So they kind of came in to country music from a different angle than I think most people would suspect. But they were very proud to be there. They were very proud to become successful. And they chased it harder than anybody. My father believed that the key to their writing success was going to be volume. They just didn't stop writing songs, and they never got married to any of the songs. That's a term that quite often is used when somebody comes to Nashville, for example. They've got three or four songs, and they're sure they're hits, and everyone passes on them, and they spend their whole career, not a successful career, their whole time in Nashville just trying to pitch those three songs because they're sure they're hits. And they've, in essence, become married to those three songs and to the exclusion of writing new songs. So my folks, when they finished a song, it was over and it was always about the next one. So they wrote a tremendous amount of volume, and when they had people that were looking for songs, Dad would study their range, look at the type songs they'd been cutting, and then just write a slew of songs, what he used to call a batch of songs for them. So when an artist would come to the house, they would have 10 or 15 brand new songs to show that artist that were absolutely geared toward them, things they thought were in their wheelhouse, range-wise, subject-wise, every imaginable wise you can think of. So they studied it. They wrote a lot of it, and they pitched it. And they were very fortunate to get a lot of those things cut. And at the same time, their publisher, Fred Rose, who had brought us to Nashville, the gentleman who started Acuff Rose with Roy Acuff, he was the pioneer of the publishing business in Nashville, the nexus of it. He had great access through Mitch Miller, a good buddy of his in New York, who was in charge of A&R for Columbia, for pop songs, whether it was Sarah Vaughan, Tony Bennett, Frankie Lane. And my folks weren't country songwriters. They were songwriters. And they certainly understood pop music. And so they were able to get a lot of their pop stuff cut through those other channels that Fred had. So they were in Nashville cutting it up with country music, pitching their pop through Mitch Miller in New York, and really became very, very quickly the most successful songwriters in Nashville to date, and indeed the first professional songwriters in Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, you talk about how they're able to write like a classic country song because they, especially your dad, understood growing up in the South and the themes of rural America. I remember Rocky Top. I'm old enough to actually remember Rocky Top when it came out. I think it was like 1967, if I remember correctly.
It came out Christmas of 67, hit the charts January of 68.
Right, and I loved it as a kid. And so when UT adopted it, when the marching band adopted that song as kind of a new feature piece, it seems to me everybody knew it already. I mean, I'd say your average Knoxvillian, let's say, knew the song. I took guitar lessons down at Pick and Grin. That was always in the books. You know, we always learned Rocky Top. Do you know what happened in terms of how the UT band picked up that song and why it took off again in this other completely different format?
Well, the fact that it took off again in a totally different format and has grown to the posture and success and just amazingly different position that it's in now is something no one could suspect would happen to a song. My parents would have never suspected it. Rocky Top came out in late 67 and was a hit in 68. And it was a bluegrass hit. About the most you could hope for with the bluegrass hit was a bluegrass hit. And that's not much. It wasn't very big, generally speaking. Rocky Top was the first bluegrass hit to ever sell 100,000 records. I was at home the day that Owen Bradley, famous producer, He's the guy who discovered Loretta Lynn and Patsy Cline and a bunch of folks. He called Dad and said, "You won't believe, but our little bluegrass record has just passed 100,000 sales." And that was amazing. That was just, it couldn't get any bigger for a bluegrass record. And immediately, Bill Anderson, who had had a big single and now had an album coming out under that same title, Wild Weekend, put Rocky Top in it. Porter Wagoner had had a big single called Carroll County Incident. He included Rocky Top in that album. Conway Twitty had had his signature country record, Hello Darlin', and included Rocky Top in that. So Rocky Top just almost immediately was set, just like the like a hook in a largemouth bass that the bass can't shake away. I mean, it was set in. And then out of nowhere, Lynn Anderson cuts a version of it, and it becomes a top five country hit. And it was huge. It was a big record. So generally speaking, that's about as much as you can hope for as a songwriter of country music, is to have a country hit that not only bifurcates from bluegrass to straight country and then is embedded in all these top albums that are coming out that year. So my folks were ecstatic. The fact that a couple of years later it was included in a medley by Dr. Julian, that a country medley that was presented at halftime at one of the football games, that's well-documented history, and I can't remember which game it was, but the fact that he heard it in that medley and felt that there was a possibility of a good reaction from it and watched the crowd, and I can't imagine the crowd having a noticeable reaction to a song in a medley, but somehow he sensed that there was something there. The fact that it was transposed for all those horns and the drums were hitting on all cylinders and it had turned from a country song to a march was amazing. And the fact that they would do that and use a bluegrass song in that setting was amazing. But he saw something in that song and started using it separate from the medley at different occasions in a game or in a warm-up session. And it didn't take too many years before it was being played when they needed a lift in the crowd, when they had a big pass or a big run, and then after a touchdown. And in very, very few years, it became somewhat synonymous with success of the team and with good things going on in the game and with pumping up the crowd. And that's just more than anybody could have ever expected a hit song to morph into. The only song I know of in my experience that has a similar arch is New York, New York. You go to a Yankees game or a Mets game, they play New York, New York, and it's not to get the crowd going nuts, though. It's just sort of, it belongs there. It somehow has this big life that belongs at large stadium events, and everybody appreciates hearing it. Some people will sing along, but Rocky Top absolutely causes people to go crazy, you know, and just euphoric and sing along. And I can assure you, my parents would have never, ever, ever suspected that. You suspect on occasions a hit. You don't suspect anything beyond that.
And it's also evolved a little bit where there's this section now where everybody yells, woo, in there that just organically showed up at some point.
I wish I really somehow knew who the genius was who did that first, or what group did that first in the stadium. I'm often asked, and my brother is also, what do you think about that? And people ask us with a tone that they're not sure what we think about there. They wonder if we like it. Well, what do you think about that? And I say, I love it. You know, who wouldn't? I mean, it's great. It's at the right spot, you know, no doubt. Good old Rocky Top. Let's see, where does it go?
Good old Rocky Top.
Woo! Rocky Top, yeah. And they say, well, what would your parents think about it? That's another, like, suspecting that it's going to be bad news. And I said, my folks would love it. Dad would wonder why he hadn't written it in himself. But they would love it. The thing that's so exciting about that to me, I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story, but then I'm going to get right back to it. Dad used to always say that his songs, that the importance of a perfect rhyme was that the audience could anticipate it a millisecond before it struck. You know, only trouble is, gee, man, everybody in the audience, first time they ever heard that song was going whiz, you know, and love hurts, love is like a stove, burns you when it's, everybody knew it was going to be hot because it was the rhyming line. A millisecond before they hear it, they've thought about it. And Dad used to say what you've in essence done is made the audience a co-writer. And they immediately are bought in. It's their song. Well, that woo isn't a rhyming line, obviously, but the crowd has bought in. It is now their song. They are, in essence, co-arrangers with everything that's going on in that song. And it's an ownership that has evolved that makes, I believe, Rocky Top so special to this school and to this region. And I think that it wouldn't be much of a surprise to any of us that the next cut of Rocky Top has a woo in it.
I don't think you could do it without it at this point, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, now we know what you think about the woo. What do you think about Rocky Top, the city? I mean, a city has changed its name.
Well, I am not necessarily thrilled about it, but you can't control success. I guess that's about all I can say about that.
We're talking with Del Bryant, whose parents wrote Rocky Top and so many incredible songs, and then went on to his own career with the performing rights organization BMI as the CEO. As a performing rights organization person, you must also look at Rocky Top as a businessman as something quite amazing, right? Are there parallels from that perspective?
Well, I was at BMI for 42 years. The last 12, I was... I headed the organization, and we were always looking out to protect songwriters and see that they were properly compensated. The key, see that they were properly compensated for their works when they were performed on air, publicly performed. It could be TV, it could be now, of course, the internet, live, cable, so forth and so on. In my retirement, looking after my parents' catalog. I and my brother have a similar business point of view, and that's protecting the songs, seeing that they aren't improperly used, seeing that they're not lifted, so to speak, and seeing that they are promoted in a way that extends their life as long as possible. BMI was the first organization to have writer awards. And to celebrate the success of songwriters with awards in a situation where we always honored the most performed songs of any given year. And we grew to include almost every genre you can think of, from television music to hip-hop to rhythm and blues to classical, so forth and so on. So I guess that moving into working with the family's catalog more, I take those principles with me. We want to celebrate the work. We want to promote the work. We want to protect the work. And we're very anxious to see that all those entities that represent us properly compensate us.
Do you have a favorite song? I know you've probably been asked this a million times, but of all your parents' songs, is there one that just really resonates with you the most?
Well, there are a number of unrecorded songs that are still some of my favorites, which I won't share because it would mean nothing to anybody but my brother and myself. But my favorite songs personally, I think would have to be two songs that it just so happens my father wrote on his own, but Love Hurts and Devoted to You. I find those so tight. I mean, you can recite them as poetry. I had the occasion to go to Bennington College once, and I was with several of the professors there that were marvelous poets. That's a very classically driven university, and they have a lot of writing courses, a lot of poetry. And I did a number of poems, just as poems, and those are so poignant, and they're so simple, and they're so perfect. And of course, Devoted to You sounds like an old almost song you would hear priests singing in an abbey, the melody and the harmonies, the way they work. Those two really have an extremely warm spot in my heart.
Did these songs go to the Everly Brothers with the harmonies all worked out, or at least indicated, or did the Everlys have a lot to do with the actual harmonies?
I think all of those answers are correct. Yeah. Dad, specifically after Bye Bye Love, only pitched them things where the harmony felt perfect for them. The more success they had, the more Dad worked in more chords and more complex melodies. And a song like Devoted to You, Dad would sit down and work with Phil a lot in getting the harmonies just right, and with Don getting the leads. Because if you listen to that song, specifically that song, it's hard to spot the harmony and hard to spot the lead. One of the big records on that was Carly Simon and her husband at James Taylor. And you can tell they're all over it. They're swapping up. It's a very difficult song to sing because the lead is not everything you think it is, and the harmony is more than you think it is. So a lot of the songs, Dad worked closely with the Everlys. They would be at the house quite a bit before some of the sessions after they'd picked songs, working on them. So Dad really exploited their ability to write more complex songs, more detailed songs, and in some way complex songs for the Everlys as the Everlys' careers progressed. I mean, songs like Sleepless Nights and A Devoted to You and a number of the songs weren't just your simple harmony, Louvin Brother kind of song. So they worked hard at getting the most appealing melodies that were consistent with harmonies. And Dad was a total musician and totally understood the mechanics of that sound. And the Everlys, no one was better.
Well, Del Bryant, it's been an absolute treat for me just to sit here and talk. I could go on and on, but I know you have other places to go in your life. But I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, Todd, I've really enjoyed it. I really enjoy talking about my folks and their talent and how they changed popular music in their own ways. And it's always nice to have somebody interviewing you that is familiar with the music. A lot of people who aren't familiar with the music don't ask quite the right questions always. And so I've really enjoyed this myself, so thank you.
I'm Todd Steed. You've been listening to The Best of Flipside. That was Del Bryant, the son of legendary great American songwriters Felice and Budlow Bryant, and also he was the CEO of BMI. He's retired now, but I still think he's out there pitching songs. Let's finish off with what must be one of the all-time great ballads, written by Felice and Budlow Bryant, performed by the Everly Brothers. This is Devoted to You.
Darling, you can count on me till the sun dries up the sea. Time, I'll adore your charm sublime. I'd be unhappy if you were blue. Through the years, my love will grow. Like a river, it will flow. It can't die because I'm so devoted to you. I'll
Wake up, little Susie, and devoted to you, both from the Bryant family, Felice and Budlow. We were talking earlier with Del Bryant. For more information on what we do on WUOT and our podcast, visit our website, WUOT.org. You can go to iTunes and just search WUOT or WUOT Studio 865, and you'll see there are, 20 or 30,000 podcasts up there. Okay, maybe not that many, maybe a few less, but you can download those and listen to them at your leisure. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can just email me something, poetry, your comments, suggestions on how to make a really delicious bowl of chili. Our email address is improv, that's I-M-P-R-O-V, I-M-P-R-O-V, improv at UTK. .edu. All right, I got to go release the hound dog. You know, there's an Everly Brothers song called Bird Dog. That's for another day.